Yeah, you're good.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Linda Teodosio, and as president of the board of the First Friday Club of Greater Akron, I would like to welcome you to today's program. Our topic for today is the Francis Mission, Inside the Church Transformation from Scandal to Hope. I ask at this time that you all silence your cell phones so that we can all enjoy today's program. At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce David Shantz of Peter Shantz & Associates, our sponsor for today's luncheon, and a member of St. Sebastian Parish, who will give our invocation. David?
If you could bow your heads. Good and gracious God, your truth is made known in your word. Guide us to seek the truth of the human person. Teach us the way to love, because you are love. Jesus, you embody love and truth. Help us to recognize your face in the poor. Enable us to live out our mission to bring love and justice to your people. Holy Spirit, you inspire us to transform our world. Empower us to seek the common good for all persons. Give us a spirit of solidarity and make us one human family. We ask this through Christ our Lord.
Amen.
At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce Diane Zbosnick, the director of the Catholic Commission of Summit County, who will introduce today's speaker. Diane?
Good afternoon. John Allen Jr. is formerly the prize-winning senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter and the senior Vatican analyst for CNN. He is now an associate editor for the Boston Globe, specializing in the Vatican and Catholic Church affairs. The author of 7 best-selling books on the Vatican and Catholic affairs, he writes frequently for major national and international publications. He is also a popular speaker both in the United States and abroad. The London Tablet has called Allen the most authoritative writer on Vatican affairs in the English language. And renowned papal biographer George Weigel has called him the best Anglophone Vatican reporter ever. When Allen was called upon to put the first question to Pope Benedict the 16th, aboard the papal plane en route to the United States in April of 2008, the Vatican spokesperson said to the Pope, "Holy Father, this man needs no introduction." That's not just a Vatican judgment. Veteran religion writer Kenneth Woodward of Newsweek describe John Allen as the journalist other reporters and not a few cardinals look to for the inside story on how the Pope's men direct the world's largest church. Allen's work is admired across ideological divides. Liberal commentator Father Andrew Greeley called his writing indispensable, while the late Father Richard John Newhouse, a conservative, called Allen's reporting possibly the best source of information on the Vatican published in the United States. His weekly internet column, All Things Catholic, is widely read as a source of insight of the global church. His most recent book, Against the Tide, The Radical Leadership of Pope Francis, he reveals a pope who has fixed his sight on reform, on accountability, and on the church's social gospel. He shows how the Pope's actions reach out to those who are disinterested, disenfranchised, and lost, and how his leadership, while beginning a new era, has roots that stretch back 2,000 years. John divides his time between Rome and his home in Denver, Colorado. He grew up in Western Kansas and holds a master's degree in religious studies from the University of Kansas. This is his 7th year to speak at the First Friday Club. We welcome John Allen.
Hello there.
Hello.
Now, I need to begin today by telling you folks something. As you just heard from Diane, this is the seventh year I've been coming to the First Friday Club in Akron, and I always have a great time here. But what is more important for your purposes is the following. My wife, Shannon, who is also my business manager and agent and kind of handles the details of my speaking gigs, has over the years, and I know this will come as a stunning revelation to everyone in this room, but she has succumbed to the charisma of Sally, and she has become a ferocious devotee of the First Friday Club in Akron. She is tremendously protective of and loyal to this gig. So on Tuesday, when I was in Rome packing my bags to fly over here, she called me and she said, look, you're going to be doing four gigs in the Northeast Ohio area, kind of one right after the other, and I want you to do a good job at all of them. But I want you to do something extra special for those people in Akron. I want you to bring them something unique. So, ladies and gentlemen, I am going to do something here today I have never done on the lecture circuit, and that is, I have door prizes for you. These are what we call in the trade, in the publishing trade, a galley. That's a pre-publication edition of my forthcoming book on Pope Francis. Not available in stores, ladies and gentlemen. Won't be out until March. We typically circulate these only to a few reviewers to kind of drum up interest in the book. But today, three lucky ones among you are going to go home with a terrific stocking stuffer for that special Catholic in your life. Now look, I don't have enough of these for everybody. I've only got three, so I decided the easiest way to do this would be through merit. And the way we're going to establish merit is I'm going to give you a brief Pope Francis pop quiz. Okay? I'm going to ask you three questions. Okay? Whoever can get the right answer to these questions gets a book. Now look, if this is a one-per-customer deal, I am sure there is some Vatican nerd in the room who could knock all of these questions down without breaking a sweat, okay? But we want to spread the wealth a little bit. So what I'm going to do, I would ask you, please, just to raise your hand. Don't shout out the answer and spoil it for everyone else, okay? Raise your hand. I'll call on you if you have the correct answer. Ashley has volunteered to be my Vanna White here today, so she will bring the book to your table. You don't have to worry about it, all right? Here we go. First question. What is the most recent foreign country Pope Francis visited, and name one thing that he did there? Yes, you, sir, in the back with the sweater.
Yes, he visited Turkey and met with the Archbishop Bartholomew.
All right, very good. It's actually Patriarch Bartholomew, but we're going to give you, you know, partial credit. All right, second question. Exactly 2 weeks from today, how old will Pope Francis be? Yes, sir.
78.
Exactly right. Bing, bing, bing. We have a winner. All right. Thank you. And here is our third question. When is Pope Francis coming to the United States, and what is the only place we know for sure that he's going to go? Yes, ma'am, in the red at the back.
Philadelphia. He's going to attend the family conference in Philadelphia.
When?
In 2015.
When?
September.
Very good.
Thank you.
20 years on the lecture circuit, ladies and gentlemen, this is a historic first for me. Never done this before, so never let it be said I did not do something unique and special in Akron here today. And Shannon, wherever you are, Akron sends its love.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Now, in addition to the door prizes, I have also vowed that I'm going to give you an original presentation here today. So even if you were with us last night at Walsh, or if you've been someplace else, this is going to be new material, I promise you. Never before rolled out, which is both a sort of It's a double-edged sword. It means the material is fresh. On the other hand, I've never had a chance to give this presentation before, so there's going to be a bit of a learning curve on this side of the podium as well as we do this. But basically what I thought I would do is begin with an observation and then try to present to you three misleading takes on that observation. So let's begin with the observation. The observation is, and this is not a hunch or a theory, this is an empirical fact, Pope Francis is today, as he became shortly after his election and has remained for the 20 months of his papacy, he is easily the most popular religious leader on the planet and one of the most popular public figures of any sort. A variety of different ways we could illustrate that mass appeal to you. I mean, for example, we could talk about his Twitter following. Do you all know he just broke the 12 million barrier on Twitter? Makes him by far the most followed spiritual leader, though not yet the most followed human being. Do you all know who that is? Single most followed person on Twitter?
Bieber.
Justin Bieber's a good guess, but bam, not quite right. The correct answer, ladies and gentlemen, is Lady Gaga. And yes, surely the apocalypse cannot be far behind. Or we could talk about the Pope's poll numbers. Again, it's a fact that in every corner of the world where public opinion can be scientifically measured, this Pope has poll numbers that politicians and celebrities would sacrifice their children to pagan gods to obtain. Okay, one recent poll in the United States found that he has an 88% approval rating among Americans generally and a 91% approval rating among American Catholics. Which, if you think about how badly divided Catholics in the United States are about virtually everything, is flabbergasting. The truth of it is, and I've been covering the Catholic Church in this country for 20 years, I can tell you for sure, under ordinary circumstances, it would be difficult to get 91% of American Catholics to agree that today is Friday. Okay? And in that context, it's staggering. Or we could talk about all the magazine covers he's been on. Times Person of the Year. He was on the cover of the Rolling Stone. And I know I'm dating myself here, but yes, I bought 5 copies for my mother. Okay. My favorite example, do you realize that he was Esquire's best dressed man for 2013? And do you all know who finished second? George Clooney! This is how you know you've arrived. Okay. So we know that the Pope is a figure who exercises tremendous interest and fascination inside and outside the Church. However, as a media professional, I will tell you that there is a kind of bizarre dynamic in this business. But sometimes the more attention we lavish on someone, the harder it becomes to figure out who they really are, because there are so many competing interpretations, so much chatter, so many different theories out there about who this person is and where they're trying to go, that it sometimes is difficult to cut through the noise. So to help you do that, what I would like to do today is present what I have come to see as three misleading narratives about Pope Francis. That is, narratives that are enormously common and widespread in most media coverage of this Pope, that certainly have their elements of truth to them, but that if pushed too far become myth rather than reality. They end up skewing and distorting perception rather than contributing to it. Okay, so let me just tick off for you these three bogus narratives that I want to explain, and then I will briefly unpack each. The bogus narratives are, one, Che Guevara in a cassock. Okay, that Francis is Che Guevara in a cassock. Two, the Benedict bad, Francis good narrative. That is, as if everything we like about Francis is somehow a repudiation of his predecessor. And three, the American bishops versus the Pope narrative, which I guarantee you is going to become increasingly widespread and increasingly talked about the closer we get to the Pope's visit to the United States next year. Okay? So let's begin with the Che Guevara in a cassock. What I mean by that is that in much media presentations of this Pope, you will find the suggestion that he is basically a closet Marxist, a kind of left-wing radical who is prepared to turn 2,000 years of Catholic teaching and tradition on its ear. And there certainly, you understand where that narrative comes from. There are elements of truth to it. It is an undeniable reality that in the political climate of Catholicism today, things are much more centrist than perhaps they have been in recent years, and the proof of that is abundant. Bishops who would have been considered too liberal for senior appointments in recent years suddenly are getting those jobs, whereas men who would have been considered perfectly suited for senior appointments are now seen, in some cases, as a bit too far to the right. There is no doubt that the trend that we saw in recent years towards ever more traditional modes of liturgical expression, a kind of high church smells and bells aesthetic with regard to worship, that has abated. Certainly the Vatican's interest in trying to reconcile with the traditionalist Lefebvreite movement has dropped off the surface of the earth, and, you know, we could go on. So there's no doubt that there has been a kind of political realignment. That said, the notion of a sharp lurch from the left to the right, as if Francis is trying to drive the church to the far left, is terribly exaggerated. In any number of ways I could illustrate that to you. We could, for example, talk about the fact that media mythology to the contrary, this is actually a robustly pro-life pope, every bit as much so as his predecessors John Paul II and Benedict XVI. For example, I was with the Holy Father during his trip to South Korea in August. He made only one change to the itinerary while he was there. He learned while he was in Seoul that at a Catholic social service center he was going to be visiting, nearby, there was a memorial to the victims of abortion. South Korea actually has one of the highest abortion rates in the world. It's a beautiful spot. It's a kind of green, grassy hilltop that is dotted with these white crosses to represent the victims of abortion underneath a large and very beautiful statue of the Holy Family. Francis asked, having learned that it was there, asked if he could go there. He spent a full 10 minutes in silent prayer at that spot, and of course brought the TV cameras and the photographers with him because he wanted that image to make the rounds of the world to set in cement the fact that he is fully committed to the pro-life cause. But I think probably the best illustration of how Francis is not Che Guevara in a cassock would come from the way he responded to the recent Synod of Bishops on the Family in Rome. This was a synod, if you don't know, is kind of a Catholic word for a summit of bishops. In this case, the Holy Father had summoned roughly 200 bishops and other participants from around the world to Rome from the 5th to the 19th of October to discuss issues related to the family. And there is no doubt whatsoever that there were three enormously controversial issues that surfaced at that synod. Now, I'm not saying these are the most important issues, but they were certainly the most divisive. And those issues were, one, how welcoming ought the Catholic Church be to homosexuals? Two, how positive should our evaluation be of different kinds of relationships that fall short of the Christian ideal of marriage? For example, people living together outside of marriage. Can we say that there are some positive values in those relationships, even though imperfect? Or is that simply encouraging people to throw in the towel on the ideal? And then the third hot-button issue with the Synod was whether Catholics who were divorced and civilly remarried without obtaining an annulment ought to be able to receive communion. Under the current discipline, they are, of course, banned. There are some bishops who believe that that ought to be given another look and be made more flexible. There was a robust, and at times, I have to say, having covered it very closely, at times acrimonious, and even nasty in a few instances, a debate around those three points. Now, of course, the $64,000 question at the end of it all was, which side is the Pope on? Okay, where is he going to come down? And at the very end of the Synod, he gave this speech, which I think is probably the most important speech of his papacy, at least so far, in which the gist of it was, he said to the people who had just lived through this enormously tumultuous debate, and in some cases were feeling divided from one another, he said, what I want to lay out is a vision in which we avoid two extremes. We avoid, on the one hand, what he described as a hostile inflexibility, that is, a kind of a priori hostility to any kind of change. okay, simply out of fear or out of resistance or wherever the wellspring of that hostility may be. But we have to reject it. We have to be courageous and bold in our pastoral choices. And he said at the other end of the spectrum, what I wish to avoid is what he called a deceptive mercy. A deceptive mercy. Now bear in mind, mercy is a core spiritual value for this pope. Mercy is literally his motto. Miserando atque elegendo, choosing through the eyes of mercy. But he said there's a deceptive form of mercy in which we feel that to be merciful to people, we can no longer tell them the truth, and we can no longer call them to moral accomplishment. And we need to reject both of those. In other words, he was saying to the liberals and the conservatives in the debate, you both are on to something, but there's also a version of your positions which, if pushed too far, becomes an ideology rather than the gospel. Okay. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, Francis is not trying to govern from either the right or the left. Okay. He is trying to govern from the center, and the center in his mind fundamentally is the gospel. He wants to bring both sides in the church's culture wars together, not allow or promote one over the other. I think the towering symbol of that was his decision to canonize both Popes John the 23rd and Pope John Paul II together. Now, it's reductive to say, but it is nevertheless a fact, that John the 23rd, in many ways, is a hero to the church's left wing and John Paul II a hero to the right. If the Pope had canonized one without the other, it would have been seen as a statement about where his sympathies lie. Canonizing them both together made it a statement about unity. Okay, and that's where this pope is coming from. It's not the victory of left over right. It's the victory of both together. As Benedict XVI said, the genetic genius of Catholicism is its capacity for finding both and solutions to what others regard as either or problems. And having quoted Benedict provides a nice segue to the second bogus narrative I want to run out for you, which is the Benedict bad, Francis good narrative. Let me tell you the way it works in my business today, the media business. Okay? Storyline in my business, in the media, for 8 years under Benedict, was that everything we don't like about the Catholic Church is because of the Pope. Okay? Today the storyline is everything we don't like about the Catholic Church is in spite of the Pope. Okay, I mean, we have set up this very invidious contrast between the two figures. Now look, I mean, again, it's not as if there aren't elements of truth to saying these are different men and different leaders. Start with the fact that Benedict, his priorities were theology and liturgy, engaging culture. You know, Francis's priorities are more the social gospel. I always said that, you know, Benedict was an intellectual who spoke not in sound bites but carefully crafted Teutonic paragraphs. Francis is much more of a populist, okay, and a pastor. Benedict the European, the consummate European, and Francis the Latin American. So obviously there are differences. Just as, by the way, there are differences between both of them and John Paul II. I sometimes say when I have to do these silly little TV gigs and they ask me what's the difference among those three popes, I usually say, well, think in terms of musical genres, okay? John Paul II was heavy metal, Benedict was classical, and Francis is folk, okay? I mean, different styles, you know, equally big audiences, but there's a different vibe, okay? Now, that said, I would suggest to you that the continuity between Benedict and Francis is actually far more profound than these points of contrast. Aside from the obvious fact that both men are sons of the church who fully embrace its teaching and so on, and aside from the equally obvious fact that both men genuinely like one another, okay, that there's a real relationship of mutual affection and respect there, Francis has often said that having Benedict in the Vatican is like having your grandpa in your house, which is a kind of curious thing for a guy who's only 10 years younger than Benedict to say. But I think he was going for cute, not so much accurate, okay? But aside from those two things, let me make two substantive points. One is that many of the reforms that have gathered speed under Francis and for which he is getting a lot of credit actually began life under Benedict XVI. For example, the financial cleanup operation of the Vatican. I don't know if you've been checking your Twitter feed today or whatever, but there's actually a story today that the Pope's new finance czar has gone around to all the different departments of the Vatican, and he's discovered that several of them had hundreds of millions of euros stashed away in secret funds that they never reported to anyone. So the Vatican's balance sheet is actually going to look a lot better this year than they thought. And it is true that Francis has moved the ball significantly on that cleanup operation, but let us never forget, it began under Benedict
secular powers from nosing around in our business. You are surrendering. This is unilateral disarmament. You are surrendering our autonomy and our sovereignty. And Benedict stared down that opposition and did it anyway. The sex abuse front is another good example. You know, Francis has created an anti-abuse commission. He has met with victims. He has launched a process to hold bishops accountable. And people are applauding that, as they rightly should. But bear in mind, again, here too, the real reform began under Benedict. Benedict was the Pope who, for the very first time, met with victims. Benedict was the Pope who made zero tolerance the official policy of the Catholic Church. We now know that during his 8 years in office, he laicized hundreds of priests who had credible allegations of abuse lodged against them. In 2 years alone, 2010 and 2011, he laicized more than 400 priests, which was 1% of the total priest corps in the entire world. And I'm convinced in the long run of history, when the story is written of the financial reform and the sex abuse reform of the Vatican, its two most persistent sources of scandal in recent years, the real reforming Pope is going to be seen as Benedict XVI, and Francis will be seen as his implementer. Okay, so the continuity there is striking. Further, you know, there are a lot of like personality features for which Francis gets credit, and rightly so. But we set it up as if it's all such a radical break from Benedict XVI. I mean, for example, his humility. Okay, we all know Francis is a humble, simple man. Okay, it's true, and he embraces those virtues. I mean, this is the kind of Pope who, the day after his election, called his newspaper delivery guy in Buenos Aires to say, "Hey, I'm not going to be coming back. Can you please cancel my subscription?" You know, this is a Pope who, you know, doesn't, when he has to get into the car, refuses to get into a Mercedes. I mean, if I were like the CEO of Mercedes, I would be terrified to have this Pope anywhere near one of our products because he doesn't want to do it. You know, when he has to drive around in Rome, he insists on taking a blue Ford Focus. Okay, and which, by the way, this has had a ripple effect in the Vatican. The other day, I was in the Corto San Damaso, which is in the Apostolic Palace, kind of, there's a parking garage there, right? And I was with a Monsignor who works in the Secretary of State, and we're going out to lunch, and he went to the motor pool, and they tried to give him a Mercedes. They're like, "Are you joking? I can't be seen in this thing. Don't you have, like, a Fiat or a Yugo or something?" So these are real virtues of Francis, but to suggest that they were not virtues of Pope Benedict, I think, is truly invidious, and not to mention inaccurate. For example, you know, another thing Francis did right after his election was he went back to the Casa del Clero in Rome, the residence for clergy where he'd been staying before the conclave, to pack his own bag and pay his own bill and then take it back with him to the Doma Santa Marta, which is the residence he's living in now. And this got spun up into this breathtaking, novel, you know, gesture of papal simplicity. Well, ladies and gentlemen, do you know what Pope Benedict XVI did the day after his election to the papacy? He went back to his apartment in the Piazza Leonina in Rome to pack his own bag and carry it back himself to the papal apartment. And before he left, he went around and knocked on the four doors of the other four apartments in this building, not to say goodbye to the cardinals who lived there, because he knew he'd be seeing them again, but to say goodbye to the nuns who did the cleaning and the cooking there and to thank them for being such good neighbors. It was the exact same gesture, basically. Now, why did we see it with Francis and not with Benedict? Well, I would suggest it's because Benedict, unfortunately, came into office with a very bad narrative. Okay, for 21 years, he had been the Vatican's doctor no, right? I mean, the great enforcer of the Holy See. And so you remember what was in the air when he was elected, right? This was God's Rottweiler, right? This was the German Shepherd. Okay, I mean, basically, his narrative made him out to be the Darth Vader of the Catholic Church, right? I mean, people could just hear the Imperial Death March in their heads when they thought about the man, right? You know, dun, dun, da-da, right? That was his narrative. And so the narrative drove, you know, what we saw about the man, and it dictated that many of his positive qualities could never rise to the surface. Whereas with Francis, he came into office without a narrative. He's been able to shape his own, and he's done it brilliantly. And while we're on the subject of humility, ladies and gentlemen, let us not forget that nothing we have seen from Pope Francis over the last 20 months would have been possible without the most staggering act of papal humility in the last 600 years, which was Benedict's voluntary decision to relinquish his hold on power and step aside. Okay, I would suggest to you that despite all of the beguiling and impressive gestures of simplicity that we have seen from Pope Francis, none of them represent the kind of humility and simplicity that was embedded in that one single decision. Okay. The point? Do not succumb to the Benedict bad, Francis good narrative, because it just ain't so. Okay? Now, finally, the American bishops versus the Pope narrative. And as I say, this is gaining traction already, and I think you're going to see much, much more of it the closer we get to the Pope's arrival in the United States. And basically, this narrative holds that a conservative-minded American bishops' conference doesn't like Francis, and so they are doing what they can to resist him. Okay? And again here, it's not like there aren't elements of truth to it. Okay? I mean, not long ago, for example, a good friend of mine, Archbishop Charles Chaput in Philadelphia, who is going to be hosting the Pope for the World Meeting of Families in September 2015, gave an interview in which he, or gave a speech rather, in which he said that media coverage of the Synod of Bishops had created confusion about church teaching, and church teaching, or in confusion rather, is a work of the devil. And this was taken in many quarters as some kind of criticism of the Synod and indirectly of the Pope, because the Pope is the one who convened the Synod. Okay? In a recent interview with me, Cardinal Francis George of Chicago, just actually the last interview he gave before he turned over the reins in Chicago to his successor, Archbishop Supich, Cardinal George ticked off a series of questions he would like to have the chance to ask Pope Francis, and one of them was, do you understand how some of the things you have said and done have created the impression that church teaching is up for grabs? Do you fully appreciate that? And during the Synod itself, one of the protagonists of the Synod was another American, Cardinal Raymond Burke, who up until very recently was the head of the Vatican Supreme Court, but has been removed from that job by the Pope. During the Synod, he emerged as a spokesperson for the conservative or traditionalist side of its arguments. And at one stage during the Synod gave an interview in which he basically suggested that Pope Francis owes the world an apology for courting confusion about where the church stands on marriage and family life. So it's not like you can't connect the dots and say that there are some Americans who maybe aren't exactly on the same page with this Pope. Perfectly accurate. However, the suggestion that there is some kind of widespread and concerted resistance from the American bishops, I think, founders on the shoals of reality for three reasons. One, we have a lot of bishops in this country, and they do not all think the same thing. Okay? I mean, we have 195 dioceses, archdioceses, and jurisdictions in the United States, which means we've got almost 200 diocesan ordinaries. You throw in the auxiliary bishops around the country, that gets us to 270. You throw in the retired bishops, that gets you to 440. 440 bishops. And ladies and gentlemen, if you don't believe it out of your own life experience, and you should, take it from me, you put 440 alpha males in a room, you are not going to have agreement on very much. Okay? So these guys are all over the map. I find it, honestly, as a reporter and an analyst, I find it meaningless to talk about what the American bishops think about anything. Okay? You have to specify which American bishops you're talking about. Okay? Some of them, no doubt, are more enthusiastic about Pope Francis than others. By the way, the same thing was true of Benedict XVI. The same thing was true of John Paul II. We have had 267 popes in the Catholic Church, and we have had 267 popes who have had problems with some of their bishops. Okay, I guarantee you, it goes all the way back to the New Testament and the clash between Peter and Paul. Okay, and so this is not only absolutely nothing new, but it is a wild overgeneralization to suggest they are all coming from the same place. Now, secondly, and I think probably more importantly, Pope Francis has called for a robust and open discussion about issues in the church, and specifically, he's called on his bishops to speak their mind. At the beginning of the Synod last October, he began, in his opening remarks, he began by reading a letter he had gotten from a cardinal about a meeting of cardinals that he had presided over in February. And this cardinal wrote to him and said, "Holy Father, I'm afraid that some of my brother cardinals didn't tell you what they really think because they're afraid you might disagree with them." And Pope Francis said, "It must not be that way. I do not want that. Please, please, please speak your minds, speak your hearts." Now, I think it is a bit disingenuous to say that every time a bishop does that, he is somehow fomenting resistance to the Pope. I mean, I think you could actually make a much better argument that when a bishop says, "Hey, I have some concerns about this thing you said yesterday," that he is actually acting out of obedience rather than defiance, because that is precisely what Pope Francis has asked him to do. Okay? And finally, third, I can tell you for sure, okay, for sure, that while it is true that some bishops in the United States, and certainly in other parts of the world, although Francis tends to be an especially tough sell in the United States for some quarters of Catholic opinion, because there's nowhere else on earth that you have a Catholic culture that is as invested in defending capitalism as we are here in the United States, and nowhere else on earth is where you stand on the life issues such a defining feature of Catholic identity as it is here in the United States. But that's it. No matter where bishops stand in terms of their attitudes towards Pope Francis, I can guarantee you that the vast majority of them have no desire to roll the clock back to 20 months ago. Okay, that is the point prior to the election of Pope Francis. And this is both for a lofty and a sort of prosaically human reason. Okay, the lofty reason is, whatever else most bishops are, they are true believers. They believe that a conclave unfolds under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, and therefore the man elected is the man God has chosen to lead the church at this time. Okay? Now, the prosaic human reason is, ladies and gentlemen, having a popular boss makes their lives enormously easier. Okay? I mean, think about the experiences bishops are having these days. When they go to parishes or they go into other Catholic venues, people aren't angry anymore, they are elated. Okay? When they go on TV, they're not getting tough questions about sex scandals and crackdowns on nuns and bruising fights with the Obama administration over contraception, even though those stories haven't gone away. For the most part, what they're getting are softball questions about what it's like to have a rock star pope. Have you met him? Is he cute? Is he as cute as he seems? Okay, that's what the conversations are like. Okay, you know, when they go into restaurants or airports or they get into taxi cabs, people from all walks of life, Catholics and not, are coming up to them and telling them how much they like the Pope. If they need a favor from a legislature in some place, it is much easier to get because no politician in the world right now wants to be seen as on the wrong side of Pope Francis. In other words, it has utterly transformed the daily qualities of their lives, and they have no incentive, therefore, to see Pope Francis fail. Okay? So, my point here is there resistance in some quarters of the hierarchy to this Pope? Yeah, welcome to the Catholic Church. It has always been thus, and it will always be so. Is that resistance any stronger now than it ever has been? No, I think in many ways it's probably less intense. Is there some kind of organized, coherent American uprising? No. Listen, folks, when Pope Francis comes to the United States, our bishops are not going to recreate the Boston Tea Party. Now, a final thought, and then we'll turn to your questions. Final thought is this. These misleading narratives, part of where these misleading narratives come from, of course, is that everywhere in the world, but in a particular way in the United States, we live in a hyper-politicized and in many ways badly divided culture. And people are always eager to enlist their heroes on their side and against the other side. Okay. Now, if we're going to counteract these bogus narratives and the misunderstandings, the misimpressions of where Francis is coming from that they betray, as a Catholic community in the United States, and we've got about, you know, a year to do it, because it would be nice if when Pope Francis came to the United States, these misleading narratives did not dog his every step. Okay? So if we're going to unravel those misleading narratives and promote more accurate understanding, I think we're going to need a lot of qualities. We're going to need persistence and imagination and creativity and all of that. But if you want to ask me, and I realize no one in this room has asked this question, but I am legendary for answering questions I have never been asked. So here we go. If you ask me, what is the magic bullet okay, the be all and end all, the magic wand that would allow us as a Catholic community to come together and in a coherent fashion try to promote better understanding of the Church and the Pope who now leads it. I will tell you that in my experience, the only way to overcome this kind of ideological acrimony, to come together, is by friendship. Friendship really is the ultimate solution that allows people to see the best versions, even of people with whom they disagree. And so I think the project for the Catholic Church in the United States over the next year is we need to become friends with one another once again. Okay, we need to reach out across the party lines and create zones of friendship in which Catholics who don't think the same way, who don't worship the same way, who perhaps don't vote the same way, and who have increasingly become strangers to one another, can come back together and become friends. And let me, to conclude, give you my proof that friendship really does work. We're going to return to where we began with my wife, Shannon. Now, let me tell you some things you need to know about my wife, Shannon. First of all, she is not Catholic. She is Jewish. Secondly, I think of her as the founder of a fourth version of American Judaism, which I like to call Obama Messianism. She is not waiting for the Savior next year in Jerusalem. As far as she's concerned, he is on the job in the White House, baby. And your moral and spiritual duty is to have his back. Okay, I mean, think of every, you know, liberal feminist stereotype our minds can conjure, okay? Birkenstock wearing, Prius driving, whale saving, granola crunching, my wife embraces them all. Okay? We live in a little intentional community outside Denver called Stapleton. Okay, and I am actually surprised that it is not a civic ordinance that every structure in this community must be painted blue, because I guarantee you this is the ultimate blue state enclave. Okay, now when I am home, those rare occasions when I am home, on Saturday mornings, my wife likes to take me out to eat to this sort of vegetarian breakfast nook that they have in Stapleton. Folks, believe me, if secular liberalism had a chapel, this is where they would go to worship. Okay? And the way I like to amuse myself when I'm there is I will plant myself in the middle of the restaurant, and once Shannon sits down at the table, in a voice loud enough for everyone to hear, I will say things like, "Honey, you know who gets a bad rap? Dick Cheney! There!" Anyway, I'm running out of time, so I've got to make this short. In 2005, I did a book on Opus Dei. Many of you probably know Opus Dei is a Catholic organization that has a reputation for being fairly conservative. So you can imagine, therefore, how excited my wife was at the idea of spending the next 18 months of our lives hanging around with these people. However, I went to 9 countries with the book. She made all of these trips, and everywhere she went, her best friends became the smart, hip, thoroughly human, funny, relaxed, diverse female numeraries, that is, you know, the consecrated members of Opus Dei. I mean, she's still Facebook friends with these people and so on. And it was killing her! Okay? Remember, I came back to our hotel room in Nairobi when we were in Kenya one night, and she was on the bed, sitting on the bed, with this look of, like, existential agony. Okay? And I said to her, "Honey, what's wrong?" And she said, "It's these Opus Dei people. I know that politically I'm supposed to hate them, but they're just so goddamn nice." And now the hilarious thing is that when my wife and I are having dinner with Catholic friends or whatever, if the conversation ever turns over to Opus Dei, I don't have to say a word. Okay, she will hijack the conversation and she will say, "Hey, you don't know these people. I do. Okay, let me tell you what they're actually like." I mean, she still has political problems, but she's gone past the mythology. Okay. The point is this. What allowed my wife to move from a place of ideological bias to a place of sympathy and human understanding? Was it some kind of argument? Was it a program? No. It was the experience of becoming friends. Friendship is the magic bullet. And that, ladies and gentlemen, I would submit to you, ought to be the project of the Catholic Church in America between now and the arrival of Pope Francis in September 2015. Let's become friends with one another once again, and let's show the world what a church of genuine friendship looks like. Thank you. God bless you.
We'd like to thank you so much for that wonderful presentation. You provided us with so much good information and kept us all entertained as well, and we appreciate that so much. I've got a few announcements, and I will try to make them as quickly as possible so we have as much time left as possible for questions, but they are very important. First of all, I want to remind you that our next First Friday Club luncheon, and I should say before I do this, if you do have questions, there are question cards on each of the tables. They're white cards. If you want to put your question on those cards and hold them up, one of our board members or volunteers will walk around to collect those so that we can have them ready for John when he comes back up. Our next First Friday Club luncheon will be on Friday, January 9th, here at the Quaker Station. Our speaker will be Brian Sinchak, president of Lakewood Catholic Academy, and the topic will be Stories of Faith in Young Adults. And please note that next month it will be the second Friday of the month as opposed to the first Friday. You will find information about next month's program and the pamphlets on your table, so I encourage you to take these home. And also, there are green sheets on each table that have to do with our subscriptions for next year. Obviously, next month we will be starting a new year of our First Friday Club series. And if you have that hard-to-buy-for person that you're looking for the perfect gift for, there are subscription options that you might want to consider with Christmas coming up. Reservations for all First Friday Club events can be made by sending your check for $15 to the First Friday Club, and the address is on the materials, as is their phone number, or you can check out the website at www.firstfridayclubofgreaterakron.org. In addition, we do have a First Friday Club of Greater Akron Facebook page that you can like and receive updates there as well. One last thing I'm going to ask that everybody take the time to do. I'm sure if you're here today, you really appreciate the quality of the speakers that the First Friday Club brings to the Akron area. And we would like to keep you informed of who we have coming and the events and all of that. And so our committee, our board, has prepared these yellow cards. If you would take just a minute to fill those out, provide us with your name, address, and email address so that we can stay in touch with you. We can keep you advised as to our upcoming program so that you can continue to enjoy this great opportunity to learn something more about our faith. So I hope that you will leave those at the table over there by our good friend Carol, who I want everybody to applaud right now for her hard work all year. In addition, a couple other groups I want to recognize very, very quickly are our high school students in attendance. Today we have students from Walsh Jesuit, Our Lady of the Elms, St. Vincent, St. Mary, and Archbishop Hoban. If those students could stand so that we could recognize them. And last but certainly not least, we have some board members that are going to be leaving our board at the end of this year. I don't believe that they are all here, but I would like to recognize them nonetheless. We've been very blessed throughout the years to have Judge John Quinn on our board, as well as Hank Hudson and Bob Bender. And we will certainly miss their wisdom and guidance as we move forward, but again, I want to recognize them. I think Bob is here, and I haven't seen John or Hank. So, Bob, thank you so much. Oh, is John here? Oh, there he is. Thank you, John. All right. Are we ready with questions, Mike?
Yep.
Okay, so I'll invite John back up, and we'll go from there. Thank you.
Sure. Did you cover the trip to Turkey? Can you comment on the Pope's visit to the Patriarch of Constantinople and the future of Catholic Orthodox dialogue?
Yes, I did. I was on the papal plane for the Pope's trip to Turkey, which, conveniently enough, happened over Thanksgiving. So, you know, it worked out perfectly. Took you a minute, but you got there. I got a million of them, folks. Francis is profoundly committed to ecumenism, that is, the outreach to other Christian churches, and in a particular way to the Orthodox. He's developed an enormously close relationship with Bartholomew of Constantinople. That said, I think he has a very realistic take that the kind of end game, formal end game of ecumenism, which is structural unity between the churches, that is sort of putting Humpty Dumpty back together again and becoming members of one common church, he would see that as a kind of very, very, very long-term objective. I mean, almost eschatological, you know. And so in the meantime, I think he is much more interested in what the different churches can do together in the here and now to promote common values. So that's why I think he wanted to have Bartholomew with him on June 8th when he welcomed the presidents of Israel and the Palestinian territories to the Vatican Gardens for that extraordinary peace prayer that he convened. It wasn't just the Pope, it was also the Patriarch of Constantinople. And that's why on the plane on the way back when he did his press conference, and by the way, Francis always does that now, at the end of every trip he comes back to the press compartment of the plane for a kind of no-holds-barred, totally impromptu press conference. And he made his remarks basically calling out Islamic leaders to be more forceful in their condemnation of ISIS. He made a point of saying, I want to do this not just in my name, but also the name of Patriarch Bartholomew, because we are brothers. Okay. I think that's his vision of the ecumenical enterprise. You know, another funny thing he said on the plane was, the theology stuff, that's in the hands of the theologians. He said, I'm a little skeptical they're going to get anything done, but I guess they have to keep doing that. But I think it's much more what we can do together in the here and now than some unforeseeable future of structural reunification that animates this book.
The report slash study of American women religious will soon be released. Which way does the Pope seem to be standing, and which way does the wind appear to be blowing?
First of all, I'm a bit skeptical myself that report is actually going to be released. They've been saying it's going to be released. I mean, if I had a nickel for every time somebody has told me that report is about to come out, I wouldn't have to be here, you know. So they say. We'll see. But let's assume it does come out, because you're right, they have set a date for it. My read is that on both sides of this relationship, that is, on the side of the Vatican and the bishops, and also on the side of the women religious, there is a kind of meeting of minds that has been reached to try to bring this whole process in for a soft landing. I do not anticipate that report is going to contain any punitive or disciplinary measures, that anybody is going to be decertified or, you know, as a legitimate Catholic outfit or anything like that. I think basically what it will say is that the sisters and the bishops have agreed to continue their dialogue, and that, you know, the sisters recognize the importance of being faithful to church teaching. The bishops recognize the importance of allowing for the creativity and autonomy of religious life, and they're going to vow to continue working together. I think that will be about it. Because I think what has happened in the years, and of course there were actually two investigations of American nuns, remember. There was one of all 476 women's religious communities in the United States, and then there was another specifically of the LCWR, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, which is the largest umbrella group for superiors of women's orders in the States. I think in both cases, what has developed since those procedures were launched is a recognition that while there may be real issues that need to be talked about, these procedures, which came off as punitive, were the wrong way to advance them. They have not really been helpful. I mean, Cardinal Sean O'Malley of Boston, in a recent 60 Minutes interview, called them disastrous. And what he meant was not that there aren't real issues that need to be examined, but simply that the way this came off has not been helpful. And so I don't think they're looking to invoke the nuclear option now, I guess would be the point.
Can you comment on the impact the book Joy of the Gospel has had on American Catholics?
I take it we're talking about the Pope's apostolic exhortation. Evangeline Gaudi. Yeah, let's get our Vatican terminology right. Okay, it's not a motu proprio. Okay, but apostolic exhortation. First of all, the one thing I will give it is I sort of get paid to read papal verbiage. And while all of the encyclicals that have come out, and this is not an encyclical, but just to compare it to that, all of those documents that have come out in the time I've been doing this job have been interesting in their own way, but many of them have been very hard for the layperson to penetrate. That is, they've been written in a kind of, and under John Paul II, they were a very philosophical language. Wojtyla's, John Paul's, basic project, was to try to reconcile Heidegger with Thomas Aquinas, which was fascinating, but half the time I had no idea what the hell he was talking about. Benedict, as I said, actually Benedict's texts were, I think, much more accessible for the non-expert in the sense that you could get from A to B to C to D to E to F very clearly, but you had to be willing to follow that entire train of thought to get the payoff. Whereas Evangelium Gaudium, I think, is probably the single most accessible papal text, that is a lengthy papal text that I've covered. So I think it is the kind of thing that many people outside the circle of initiates, did at least take a look at. But I think probably less impactful here or anywhere else than the document was the spirit the document represented. Okay, what you got in that document was a sort of vision statement from Pope Francis of the kind of church he wants to lead, and I think probably the clincher phrase of that document and the one that kind of made the rounds of the world was this idea of the church as a field hospital, right? Sort of the emergency room in which the wounds of a broken and bruised and hurting world can go to be cured. Okay, I think people found that very inspirational and a very attractive vision. Whether they know it came from Evangelium Gaudi or not, I think that vision, and the fact that they associate Francis with being serious about it, right, that it's not just rhetoric, but they think he actually wants to walk that talk. I think the logical companions to Evangelium Gaudi really aren't other papal documents. They're more papal gestures. I think in many ways, like John Paul II, Francis often communicates much more with his gestures than he does with his speech, right? So, for example, when people saw him in St. Peter's Square stopping the Pope Mobile and getting off of it, because out of the corner of his eye, he has caught sight of a guy who has a horrible genetic skin disease that has left his body completely disfigured with boils. The kind of guy most of us would cross a sidewalk to not have to run into. When they see the Pope hopping down off the Pope Mobile and sprinting over to this guy and wrapping him in an embrace and kissing him on the top of his head, okay, then when he talks about a field hospital, it seems credible to them. Or when they see the Pope inviting three homeless guys up for his birthday breakfast. By the way, it wasn't just the three guys, it was their dog. Dog's name, as a footnote to the story, Marley, for the reggae icon Bob Marley. Francis is a pope of firsts. I guarantee you this is on the list because it was the first time the name Bob Marley had ever been uttered in the corridors of the Vatican. I talked to these three guys later and I said, did the Pope know who Bob Marley was? And they said, no, but we explained it to him and he thought it was cool. when people see stuff like that, it makes the language of something like Evangelium Gaudi, I think, more credible, right? And I think that, rather than perhaps each and every paragraph of the document, I think that's probably been the source of his greatest impact.
Just a comment. Tell Shannon happy birthday with love from Akron. We love you both.
Now, somebody who really knows my wife set that one up, because her birthday is actually tomorrow. Yeah. It's a very topical thing. So have my wife's birthday in mind tomorrow, have the Holy Father's birthday in mind in 2 weeks, and have my birthday in mind on the 20th of January. It's going to be my 50th, ladies and gentlemen. So a kind of life watershed moment coming up. Do you know where I'm going to be on January 20th? I am going to be flying back on the papal plane from the Pope's trip to Sri Lanka and the Philippines. So never let it be said I am not over there carrying the cross for all of you. Is that it? Are we done? Okay, listen, once again, from the bottom of my heart, I can't thank you enough for the hospitality and the friendship, and I want to use that word deliberately, the friendship that you have shown me and my wife over the last 7 years. And, you know, God willing, inshallah, next year will be 8. Thanks, God bless you.
One thing I neglected to mention earlier, there will be a podcast of this presentation and all the First Friday presentations on our website, so please encourage folks that weren't able to join us today to listen to this wonderful presentation. At this time, I would once again like to thank Peter Schantz and Associates for sponsoring today's program and invite Patrick Klanick of that organization to come forward and lead us in our closing prayer. Patrick?
Let us bow for the peace prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is dying that we are born to eternal life. Amen.
On behalf of the entire board, I would like to wish all of you a very blessed and happy Christmas, and we hope to see you next year. Be safe going home. Thank you.